Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and joining me again is one of my favorite guests and one of my most frequent guests. It's Julie Nurnberger-Haig from Kent State University. Julie, thanks for being back on the podcast.
Thank you again, Sam. I thank you every time for doing this service and sticking with it through the pandemic. I mean, you're just amazing what you do for this field. And I'm just fortunate that when I reached out and said, hey, I have an article coming out right now online first. Do you have time for me? That you actually did. So thank you.
Yeah, I always enjoy reading your stuff, not just because I'm a parent of young kids, but also, yeah, I just appreciate your perspective on work. In terms of doing the podcast and keeping it going, you know, I want to do more episodes. I'm hoping next year maybe I do, but my key is to have the guests do most of the talking. That makes it easier on my end. But yeah, for you, this is your fourth time, which puts you in kind of exclusive company. I think it's just you and Mandy Jansen.
Wow.
And Bill Zahner is like nipping at your heels with, I think, three visits. But yeah, always good to talk to you. And in the past, we've chatted about your research, looking closely and using some theoretical frameworks to understand children's books and like children's shape books, children's math books. So a lot of interesting things about this other realm of how kids learn math and get exposed to math ideas through children's books. Today, we're going to have some fun at the end of the year, and we're going to think about some math games. But first of all, I wonder if you can help us connect the dots about how your research has gone from children's books, but also now including experiences with children's math games.
With regard to games, at first, I didn't know how at first that it was connecting. But what happened is actually that Jamie Wernette partnered with me to refocus on my integer work that I had started as a graduate student. And we worked on integer models and contexts because she focuses on contexts for math learning and I focus on models. And we weren't going to analyze the game aspects of this huge data set of classroom observations from more than two weeks of work and tests and paper. But we saw students shutting down during some of the games. And we said, whoa. These are supposed to help students and it's marginalizing at least some of them. We need to look at this. Games already fit with Jamie's work of in contexts. Games are a context for learning. But when we started working on this and writing this up, I realized, okay, this fits the bigger picture of what I do with my base 10 number work, my integer work, my children's books, the intended and unintended consequences of the mathematics resources we use, both in classrooms formally and informally before they're ever in school or out of school while they're school age.
Yeah.
And if I said children, that's because I've been teaching instead of students. I had to train myself. I was a secondary math teacher, but once I started teaching future early childhood teachers, I had to switch my language to children. And sometimes I forget to code switch when I'm back talking to a broader audience.
Yeah. Well, we can get into this article. You mentioned Jamie Wernette is a co-author with you and also Judy Benjamin. And this article is available in the International Journal of Education in Mathematics, Science, and Technology. So this is the IJEMST journal. There's some other journals that have similar letters, but this one is the International Journal of Education in Math, Science, and Technology. And the article is called Gameplay in Perspective: Applications of a Conceptual Framework to Analyze Features of Mathematics Classroom Games in Considerations of Students' Experiences, or children's experiences, as it were. So we're going to hear from some children's perspectives as they experience these games and how they felt about it and what they were getting out of it. But before we get to that, I wonder if you could just set the stage. There's three key games that are like, you know, central in this article. I wonder if you could just give us, I know it's hard in a audio format, but can you give us a quick like orientation to the three games?
I think I can. So first of all, the data from this article was on a review day. So these games were all just meant to be experienced 10 minutes at a time rotating. And two of the games were designed for classroom use. One of the games is a commercial game. The two games that were designed for classroom use, one of them is from CMP or Connected Mathematics Project, the integer product game. And also, I did find there's an online free access version to it as well. But we analyzed the physical printout that the students were playing. The other classroom game is Go High, Go Low, which was published in, I think, 2019 in the Ohio Journal of School Mathematics. So that's open source. And then the commercial game is Integers 24, which many of our audience might be familiar with the franchise of the 24 games, because they have them for fractions, integers, whole numbers, lots of different aspects. So the commercial game are cards, a single card that a group plays around, and everyone is trying to add, subtract, multiply, or divide to get either 24 or negative 24 with the four numbers on the card. The integer product game is a grid with products on it, and at the bottom there are integers. On the printed game versus the online game, it's, I believe, negative 6 to 6. Pairs play to pick factors and try to get 4 or 5 in a row. I forgot exactly how many in a row. And the go high, go low has, first you play, find the greatest number, and then the second time you play, it's to try to get the least number. And you use a positive die, like a positive negative die that only has those, not magnitudes on it. And then another die for the magnitude. And ideally 3 students, but you could change however many groups of people need to be in your group. Each takes turn rolling to get the quantity that they're supposed to add or subtract, but they get to decide whether they are going to add or subtract to get the highest number or the lowest number, with the intention being, I'm sure most of the listeners who are familiar with math ed know where we're going with this, that the idea is that you're figuring out, oh, subtracting doesn't always make a number smaller, and that this game is mainly set up to spark that idea, but also then to build fluency, which the Integers 24 is to build fluency. The Integers product is building fluency just with multiplication and maybe with division.
So are the children in the classroom there able to go around and play each of these games like at different stations? So the kids have had experience with multiple games, right? They can kind of compare and contrast the games.
So in this article, earlier in the unit, when it was time for them to learn how to add and subtract, they played Go High, Go Low before. Mm-hmm. Integers 24, they were introduced to at some point during the unit as just a practice for fluency. And then on review day, which is where this data comes from, all students rotated through all 3 games. Yeah. In their group and to a review station where they were just working on a review packet with the teacher support. Okay. And so we had video cameras at each game station, as well as trying to take notes. And then additional data comes from interviews that we videotaped asking them about their opinions. So we have qualitative ideas as well as ratings of how fun do you rate this? The learning, how do you rate this in terms of learning? Mm-hmm. And also, would you recommend this to teachers? Mm-hmm. Let's get the students' perspective. And we wanted to know, which leads into other things, we wanted to know, would they play this outside of school? Does it really mm-hmm. feel like a game? Does mm-hmm. it really feel like an authentic game? Or is this just something contrived for our learning again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's perfect for where I wanted to go next, which is just that you were in this article examining the students' experiences playing these games. And so I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about how did you look at students' experiences and what was the kind of construct that you applied to think about students' experiences?
One of the contributions of the article and is the way we looked at it is realizing that we didn't have a way to understand games, even though we had a lot of understanding collectively about math learning. So we started reading about game design and game design theory. So our conceptual framework, we call it the math games features framework, so that we're actually looking at the features of the games, just as we look at the features of a task, because we perceived games as a specific kind of math task. And so we feel like we couldn't find that in prior work that's been done in our field. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist. To all those grad students out there, Jack Smith trained us both well. That's we can't claim it's not out there, but we didn't find it. And we also, when we read the game work, including articles about learning math, nobody references math ed work. It's mainly more psychology and quantitative and skill-based assessments. So we thought we should use the cognitive demand framework seemed to fit as we viewed games as a type of task. And we also, part of why we did this and part of why we made it open source is we want the success, these kinds of frameworks to be accessible to teachers, that it shouldn't require a translation from researcher to teacher. And so we have the math task cognitive demand framework as our math specific framework to see it, the tasks. And also thinking about in our diagram in the article, the thinking about the specific learning purpose. So integer product is really focused on multiplication, a little bit on division, maybe if you think of it that way. Go high, go low is adding and subtracting. Integers 24 is all four operations. Like, what's the actual purpose of what they're trying to do? And then taking the games, theories from games, and there was so much we could have used, but what we thought was most important was the competition versus cooperation, synchronous versus asynchronous play, and the skill versus chance balance. In fact, I believe it's Shell that we cite who said it determines the character of your game. I think I quoted that pretty closely. And so that's really powerful to think, okay, so those were aspects we looked at. And then both Judy and Jamie, the co-authors, have more experience with motivation theory and things like that and the anxiety literature. And so we looked at all of these things about the games features and then, okay, how do the students feel about this? What do they say? How do they rate the games? How do they recommend them? And then also what I didn't mention earlier is as I said, we had a video camera. So we did some observations of the actual engagement during the game to try to assess how engaged were the students in each game and figure out why. And in particular, it wasn't just general, because my initial thought was it seemed like the students who might be lower performing were the ones shutting down at a particular game. And that actually didn't pan out. And that's the really cool thing about having the time as a researcher, unlike a classroom teacher, to be able to watch videos and listen to what they said and dig in for all those hours and look for patterns in the data and say, there actually is not a pattern in the data by achievement. It's more about personality and features.
Well, let's get into some of those student experiences and what they shared with you. So we can kind of go by different categories. You mentioned that you asked for students' recommendations and like how they enjoyed it. So maybe first just let us know what you found when you asked for them. Did they recommend the game? Did they enjoy playing the game?
So they did like playing games in general. So that is consistent with people's general claims that, hey, you should play games. When we look at the actual games the students played and how they provided responses. So as I said earlier, we were really interested in whether they recommend teachers use the games. And about 3/4 of the students recommended go high, go low to teachers. A little over half recommended the integer product and the integers 24. And we can get into more about why that is. And I also have some ratings for fun. But whether they thought of it as an authentic game that they would actually play outside of school, 70% said they'd play go high, go low outside of school, which that's a majority, which was surprising. And integers 24, it was less than half would play outside of school. And integers product, it was really only about 1/3 would want to play that outside of school if it weren't actually assigned as homework. But in terms of fun, it was interesting, even though they rated it more fun than recommending to teachers. Like those scores came out a little higher. Because in my memory, I was thinking most of them were more recommended. So here's, in terms of whether they thought the game was fun, 90% rated go high, go low as fun. 74% rated it integer product as fun. And just 45% said integers 24 was fun.
So it's pretty fun, but that doesn't mean they want to do it outside of class. And it doesn't even mean that they would necessarily recommend that their teacher keep doing it. So it's you're kind of getting at, you're circling the same sort of phenomenon, but you're actually getting a little bit different slice of it with each of those questions.
Exactly. And also we did ask them about learning, and it was really neat how thoughtful and insightful they were, you know, these middle schoolers, and how we need to listen to them, you know. For example, so we framed it as, because it was a review day, you're at the point where you're supposed to be getting fluency, not initially developing concepts, right? So even though as educators, you and I and most of the listeners are working towards that, and we wouldn't want to talk about worksheets, to ask them to rate it for a review, we said, compared to a worksheet, did you learn better? And we had a 5-point rating scale that we then collapsed to 3 just because there's so few students. In terms of go high, go low, 70% said it was better learning than a worksheet. The integer product game, only 21%, so about a fifth, said it was better learning than a worksheet. Integers 24, 75% said better learning than a worksheet. So better, and in this case, because we're talking about worksheet and it was on review day, it was really about, you know, how does it help your review? I encourage you to read the article. The things they say are so interesting. we had such fun, including the people we acknowledge in the acknowledgments, who are future teachers, had so much fun analyzing what the students said. What we ended up doing is creating a balance for the types of things they said, whether it was positive, negative, or neutral about a game. And we did a ratio. So go high, go low had a 17-3 ratio of positive to negative themes that came up. Integer product had a 13-3 ratio. And integers 24 had a 17-6 ratio. So go high, go low and integers 24 were about the same in their positive, or were exactly the same, 17 positive themes. But the integers 24 had twice as many negative themes come up as go high, go low.
So this is great to get a kind of sense of how the students and the children were feeling about it. But then when you tied this to game features, and when you thought about that framework that you kind of assembled to think about these math game features, how did it relate to the features of those games? And what was kind of going on differently in this game versus that game? And did you see some patterns there?
All of these games that were provided on review day were competitive. So we can't claim they wouldn't respond similarly or differently to cooperative games. But the word competitive was so often used in their responses as positive that we actually, that's one of the things they liked. That the
Did even the losers liked that?
Well, I mean, since overall competitive was a major theme, I would say yes. But the way it was competitive is what changed things. Go high, go low. So if you're reading along on figure 3 with the framework, so you see that all of the games have the competitive feature. But go high, go low has an asynchronous, and so does integer product, where there's turn taking. But integers 24 is synchronous. And what we found is that synchronous with the competitive combined with being purely skill was very stressful for some students. It was highly motivating and helped. One person said something, I was focused and concentrated for another. And that's what we care about. You know, I have a background also in doing mixed methods that is more quantitative. So I value statistical analyses, but almost all the statistical analyses we do are about checking averages and comparing the average performance and if it's significantly different, or average perception. And we really wanted to have every voice heard. So the go high, go low game had chance and game strategy and math skill. So from game design theory, they talk about strategy or skill, and we clarified it for this purpose as the skills being a game strategy or a math skill. Mm-hmm. So go high, go low is a combination of all three. Integer product was a combination of game strategy and math skill, but there was no chance involved. Everybody has the same board. The game strategy is in where do you place your factor to try to get your 4 or 5 in a row. And the integers 24 is purely skill. So pure skill with synchronous with competitive marginalized several students.
That's the integers 24. Yeah. It's competitive, it's synchronous, and it's basically math skills is what you're doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what we took from this is to avoid marginalizing any student in class, either we don't offer a game or we don't require a game because we're requiring them to do things in class, right? It's not like an out of school game where they could choose. That we make sure there is a chance skill balance, which levels the playing field. It differentiates the game without making it a big deal. So you have a special ed background as well, right? So that everyone has access to being able to do this, and that it's not that there is turn taking built in, or change the game so it does have turn taking. So maybe it's you don't play a certain game, or maybe you just modify it by taking a certain element, changing it to having dice or a spinner or a random number generator. And the cool thing about, for example, Go High, Go Low, you could use different dice. So you could do it with traditional dice or numeral dice that are up to six, or you could do it with 10-sided dice or 20-sided dice, which is what we did.
So just to sort of make sure I'm getting some of these ideas, is the synchronous part adds a pressure that can be off-putting for some students, and it might be like, no, we want to make sure they're included and that they're feeling good about the play. And the asynchronous, you're talking about as turn-taking, that can change the feel of the game and try to include more. I also do like what you said, too, about having the chance involved. The chance involved, the way I thought about it as you were speaking, is that the chance provides a little bit of cover, where it's like we're not just exposing people's math performance in front of everybody in this like competitive cutthroat sense. It's like, no, we have some chance involved, which means actually that mixes it up a little bit. It also can just provide cover for you. Like if you're having a little bit of struggles with the math side of the game, you have a little bit of face saving, because you can be like, well, there's a little bit of luck involved, so maybe I was just a little bit unlucky. So it maybe just puts everybody just a tiny bit more at ease to have some chance involved, you know, around the math skills.
Yeah, that's cool. In the game design theory work we heavily cite, I believe it was Shell, said that having alternating chance and then skill creates a relaxation and attention, like back and forth, that a lot of people like in their games. And some of the student quotes literally said pressure about integers 24 and relaxed, or the word relaxed was actually used, or easygoing about go high, go low, because of that chance feature. And several of them said, I love playing with dice. So we asked if it, you know, if you'd played out of school, or that they brought up the ones that have chance were the ones they could play out of school.
Right. And the go high, go low was the one that the students seemed to appreciate quite a lot, and they recommended pretty highly. Yeah. I wonder if you wanted to also comment on the cognitive demand, because you said you sort of thought of these games as a type of task. It's kind of a special type of task, but I wonder if you want to sort of close out the findings with a little bit of a comment about that part.
Yeah, it was interesting. Our initial perception of some of the games' demand levels before we really did thought about it, and then also looked at students' responses to see how it actually was implemented versus intended, as the original Stein-Smith work says. So the go high, go low, we determined was high cognitive demand, and the student responses, the qualitative responses seem, we provide evidence that we believe that's supported as well. The integer product, we and the students seem to agree that it actually was a low cognitive demand, even though it was designed for classroom use. It's just about multiplication for the most part, and it's more just about doing the procedure. I mean, finding the calculation each time. Integers 24, I actually was initially thinking, well, it's just skill-based, so it might be low cognitive demand. It might just be procedures without connections. But when we thought about it more and we look at some of the student comments, we actually determined it to be high cognitive demand, because you had to problem solve what's going to happen if you do this or that while you're doing all these operations, and keep that in mind.
Yeah, I can see the procedures with connections on that 24, integer 24, because you're not just thinking about the operation that you're computing, you're also thinking about how it actually relates to other operations that can be done around it. And so there's a little bit of interaction that's a little different. But the last thing I did actually realize I wanted to get your thoughts on were that you, in your analysis, you actually did identify students who are high achieving in math and students who are low achieving. And I wonder if just how you see that layering over the findings that you were just discussing.
Yeah, we did. In the article, you'll see there are separate analyses about this, because as I said, as an observer, my initial interpretation was that that's who was shutting down. And that turned out not to be the case. We triangulated the data. We mixed the data at the interpretation phase in several different ways about the ratings they offered, as well as that's where we actually observed the students' engagement in the groups, and followed students at each game to rate whether they were fully engaged, mostly engaged, somewhat engaged, or never engaged in the game. And we actually found no patterns of engagement based on their achievement. So it really is more about personal, individual complexities and the features of the game, as opposed to thinking that a certain achieving level wants this game or that game. And so it's a non-result that I think is an important result.
Yeah, and definitely more details in the article. So I encourage people to check that out. Also in the article, you have quite a few implications and connections that you discuss. You make connections to research, to practice, to quite a few things. But I wonder here, you know, just for the episode, if you want to just grab one takeaway and share that, having done this analysis with your colleagues, you know, what's the one takeaway that has really hit you from this work?
Well, bear with me, Sam. I have to do a teacher ed takeaway and then talk about the teaching, like the real practice of it all.
All right. Your takeaway can have two parts.
Okay. Thank you. So because this analysis, so I'm going to start with the teacher focus. So as you might predict, based on the things we said before, it was what features should we be are most likely to support all of the students in our class and not marginalize anyone. I can't guarantee it, but our try, right? So we have a bulleted list of features that we suggest that so far it seems high cognitive demand that they actually appreciated that and recognized that, even though they're middle schoolers, right? That they had comments about their learning. They liked the competitive nature. Even the ones who said they had high anxiety liked the competitiveness. It just needs to be done in a way that has all three features of game strategy, plus the math skill, plus the chance is crucial. And asynchronous play, so they get a chance to take turns, so there's not the stress of the time pressure. And we also threw in the versatile purpose. They did like the go high, go low, that at one point in their unit, it was a learning game, and then it was a review game at the end. So in regards to authentic play, that's important. If we ask our students, what games do you like to play at home that aren't video games, then we could get insights into what games they like. Because one of the things from game design theory, and we mentioned it in the article, is people like playing a game that's like another game they like, but different enough to be different. So people compared Integer Product to Bingo and Go High, Go Low. They love dice. Integers 24 was only compared to the math competition game Crypto and Mathorama. Now, what this did for me as a teacher educator helped me finally figure out how to help my future teachers understand the difference between a game that families can play together or that people would choose to play and thoroughly enjoy versus an instructional activity in a classroom. Because I was really having trouble articulating that sense that I had that, no, adults and children aren't going to play this together the way you've described what you're offering at home. It's just a classroom activity where the adult's going to play a certain role. But if we know these are the criteria for a game, and chance means that the adult might not always win, instead of it just being skill-based, it changed my teaching practice for my methods courses and how I could support them. And so I hope it will for others as well, in addition to what we do with actual classrooms choosing games, and then research and scholarship that we actually use game design theory as we think about games, as well as actually specific frameworks from math ed instead of what is typically done in other fields about math games.
Well, thanks so much for sharing about that work, Julie, and it's been great talking to you. And I just want to thank you for being a guest to help us wrap up 2022 in the math ed podcast season. We do have a new year, 2023, coming right around the corner. And I know it, you know, you have some things you're involved in, both in research and working as a kind of math specialist in high need schools. But I wonder if you want to just share a little bit about your professional goals and things you're looking forward to in the new year.
Oh, thanks, Sam. Yeah, I am really excited for the future. We've all been through a lot in the last few years, because of the pandemic, and many of us just from other things that are normally happening in life, but we really took a hit in our life. And for personal reasons, I had to make the really difficult decision to step away from my tenure track position before I ever submitted my tenure file, just to make sure that I prioritized our personal situation so that I could keep doing this work long term instead of making the future less possible, let's put it that way. But really, I just have always been passionate about making a difference. And I grew up in a high need school district. And there are certain things with my research that I'm really focused on. And I became more focused, like to be able to articulate them just within the last year. Within the next 10 years, I want to spark a shape utopia in which we are no longer giving children from birth inaccurate shape information. And with the forthcoming article in Mind, Brain, and Education, that we have a way forward for how to teach shapes better. My integer work, I'm so excited. Two of the articles that are open source this year, this article and one that's the integer test of primary operations, that hopefully anyone doing scholarship in negative numbers will use as a validated and reliable measure to change integer instruction, and my base 10 work. So I'm very excited about all these things, but I have to temper it with what we can handle with, and that's why I had to step away from my position. And we know how tenure tracks work, so that it's not like a colleague who was a teacher and she was able to step away for a year and go back part time and then, or 2 years, and then have a job waiting for her. That's not how our tenure track works. And so I had to make that difficult decision. But what I am doing right now, probably for the next 2 years, and then we'll see where that takes me, is I'm a visiting scholar now in the Department of Psychological Sciences, also at Kent State. And I am working in high need districts as a consultant as I can fit in, for the time that we have to fit in these things.
Well, Julie, again, I'm glad to have you on. You basically have an open call, as a anytime with those new articles coming out. I'd love to have you back. I appreciate all your work and really do wish you the best in your work next year.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Math Ed Podcast from mathedpodcast.com. And another resource that I'm reviving is mathedjournals.com. This is a list of journals that publish research and practitioner pieces in math education. Some of them are very well known in math ed, and they publish exclusively math education research, but others are education research journals that are just known to publish math ed work from time to time. This list of math ed journals is meant to be a shared resource that's helpful for people as they are writing and thinking about submitting their work. So if you're thinking about submitting a math ed article for publication, check out mathedjournals.com to help you think through those venues. We have compiled the links to the author guideline web pages. There's a list of the word limits for each journal, the impact factors, the review times, and other helpful information. I want to give a special thanks to Tiffany LaCroix, Faustina Ba, and Becca Hannock for helping me revive and update the list. And if you want to help us maintain and even add to mathedjournals.com to make it even better, please send your Google account info to me at ottensa@missouri.edu and put Math Ed Journals in the subject line, and I'd be happy to add you as a collaborator.